You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Hello, hello. This is a very special episode of Future Fridays with a very good friend. Hero of mine, in fact, is Brendan Kelly of the Lawrence Arms. I consider him a wonderful friend and a mentor. I absolutely worship the Lawrence Arms, if you can tell from listening to our records. I love his writing back at his blog, Bad Sandwich Chronicles. His shit he's done with the Falcon, his solo shit under Brendan Kelly and the Wandering Birds, his Nihilist Arby's Twitter account. The guy is brilliant, and being in his presence is just fantastic. He's like the culmination of that quote that brevity is the soul of wit. You know, you hang out with Brendan, and the shit that comes out of the guy's mouth is just so good, so insightful. So the thing about this podcast is that it was recorded over a year and a half ago. I waited to put it out because I was afraid that I was going to let the podcast fail, and in so I'd be letting Brendan down, letting you guys down, listen to it, letting all the other guests down. I think that was a really stupid way to think and a dumb way to operate, and realize that there is no failure in doing something that I love like this. And so many people have come up to me at shows and talked about how they enjoyed listening to the episodes, that I think it's really time to just kind of let this thing ride. And I'm having so much fun, and I'm just going to put out as many as I can. I'd like to give a quick shout out to Sean and the folks over at Ridge.com for sending over some awesome stuff. Thank you so much for that. Ridge makes these heavy-duty, streamlined, kind of minimalist wallets, phone cases, and bags, which are pretty fantastic for touring. You know, smashing and losing shit on tour is something that happens to me constantly, because I could be a dumb. But yeah, so thanks, so many thanks to the folks at Ridge.com for sending that shit over. All right. Enough rambling, on to one of my favorite conversations with one of the wittiest and insightful people I have the pleasure to know, Brendan Kelly.
All right, it's working. But yeah, thank you so much for doing this with me, Brendan.
Of course, man.
Yeah, man, you've been a huge influence on us as a band, and also integral part of us becoming a band on Red Scare.
Well, hey, you guys are a great band. I'm just happy to be along for the ride.
Hell yeah, thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah, dude, I remember the first time that we had met you was at the fest. We were playing at the Market Street Pub, and you came up and introduced yourself at the merch table. And I was like, shit, that's that guy? Fuck yeah. And then you got Toby to watch us, and that night we drank a lot of liquor along with the singer of Look Mexico, old Matty.
Oh, yes.
And then he had to leave in an ambulance.
Yeah, well, you know, the fest can be dangerous, right?
Yeah, yeah, it most certainly is. So I didn't want to go full Nardwar on you, but I was like reading some of your guys' older interviews and found out some stuff about you that I didn't realize.
Okay.
You lived in Belgium when you were a kid?
Yeah, I mean, when I was very, very young. Okay. Like so my parents were divorced before I was born. And so as soon as I was like old enough, I think my mom wanted to like get far away from that whole situation.
Yeah.
With no disrespect to my dad, I think it was just like a bad situation, and they she wanted to bounce. So we moved, and I lived in London and then Belgium when I was real little. That's like where I learned to speak and stuff like that. But I don't have too many memories of it or anything.
Nah. But Ben, you were born in Missouri.
Born in Missouri.
Yeah.
Yes. Into a, cast iron bathtub. No. from what they tell me, I was born in a Nashville hospital.
Yeah, that's how they do it there. And then, of course, you grew up here in Chicago mostly.
Yes, correct. I grew up in Boys Town, which is not that far from where we are right now.
Yeah, no shit.
And it's like, it's the first, like, I think, like, municipally recognized gay community in America.
Ah, no shit.
And, yeah, it's a pretty interesting place to grow up. When I was little, it was kind of just becoming Boys Town. Yeah. And then to see it, like, really flourish and become, like, a celebrated part of the community is... You don't see a lot of I say you don't see a lot of stuff like that, as though I've lived 100 lives. I don't know, maybe everybody sees that stuff. I don't have any idea. I find it to be unusual and cool.
Yeah, totally. It seems like growing up there as a kid, if it was just becoming Boys Town, the what we know it as today, that there'd be an influx of really more open culture.
Like, yeah, things, so there's like a movie theater around the corner from my house, and next to it was a shoe repair place, and I shoe repair in quotes because it was really like leather goods. Yeah. And the big picture in the front window which is like etched in my brain, was this huge veiny hard on just like strapped up with leather. And I was like, that's a weird foot. That's a weird shoe.
You ask your mom what it is, you get a weird answer.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, so fascinating, fascinating little part of the world at that time.
Yeah, definitely. And you went to Northwestern, which is here, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
Did you go to school for movies?
Yeah.
Did I make that up? Filmmaking.
And then I had like a heavy concentration in like world literature. But yeah, I went to learn to like make movies, like sort of like the science behind it. Like I was like cutting film with razor blades and shit. Whoa. Like that. And like, you know, developing my own film and also doing like screenwriting and directing and photography stuff. But yeah, it was it's a Bachelor of Science degree that I have.
Yeah.
So it's, you know.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I felt like when I went to college, I was like, I could, if I just like major in like, let's say, English or history or something like that, I'm basically just getting graded on what I already know.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
And like, before I went to school, I've always been a bit of a Luddite and a technophobe. And I was like, man, I can't even fucking turn on a camera. It would be, if I'm going to go to college and, you know, get this like world-class experience, I should come out of it knowing something I didn't know when I went in.
Yeah.
So I picked that sort of as a challenge, something that was like still like artsy and fruity enough that I could enjoy it,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
and then,
totally.
But also something that I didn't have any sort of background in or understanding of.
That's awesome. That's like always been a fantasy of mine, would be to go to college to learn a skill that don't have any type of, you know, residual or anything, knowledge about it at all. Like go in and just become like an engineer or something like that.
Yeah, totally. That, you know, and I mean, it's not for everyone, but I was just like, you know what? I know that I can read books and my reading comprehension is good.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like I don't think I need to go to, like I could take some classes on the side to turn me on to books that I wouldn't otherwise read.
Yeah.
You know, and that was very helpful. I mean, I think that's probably the best thing I got out of college was the sort of compendia of titles and authors that I would never have otherwise been exposed to, you know, and I would never pick up on my own. Like that's, so in a way, I guess I'm undermining my own point here.
Yeah, right? Came full circle.
But yeah.
Yeah, I think that there's a whole lot of people in of the particular position that you and I are in that went to school for English or, you know, one of the ones that the joke is that you become like a well-read waiter afterwards.
Yeah,
know?
Exactly.
And, I always thought that too. Until recently, I've read a quote of somebody talking about how they did major in English and what it allowed them to do as far as communication skills goes was just like, you know, help them in any other endeavor they went on in life. And I was like, I guess that kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
You'd be, like you said, you'd be forced to read and see so many viewpoints that you normally never would.
Totally. I mean, like, so I took Latin throughout high school and college. And obviously Latin is in many ways a completely useless thing to learn. Sort of ancillary effect of taking a lot of Latin, it's all a lot like Karate Kid, where like he's like waxing cars and painting fences and shit like that for a long time, and then he's like, "What the fuck am I doing?" And then all of a sudden, Mr. Miyagi's like, "Check this out!" And he's like, "Oh, I've been learning karate the whole time." It's like I came out of 6 years of Latin. I lit a candle in the Latin Honor Society.
Yeah, no shit.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Hey.
Very important. I came out the other side with just like such a more robust vocabulary and understanding of English, which, shit, that's very helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. I would imagine that the Latin Honor Society ceremony would either be the worst party or the greatest party.
The first one.
Okay.
I was 16 years old. I lit a candle. I set it on some sort of dais, and
nice.
It was with all the other complete dorks
that
like myself
Latin.
That
yeah.
took enough Latin to. I mean, that's the reward. You light a candle.
Yep, that was the culmination of studying the dead language. I had I took one semester of Latin in high school. I went to the first 2 years. I went to high school. I was transferred to a Catholic school, and it was compulsory to take Latin.
Yeah. Yeah,
I didn't retain anything.
I absolutely wish I could speak another language. I also don't think that my brain is Like, you strike me. You speak a little Spanish and stuff,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I speak a little Spanish.
Yeah, so. You're like, I don't have that. You know, I think that, like, I'm a simpleton, and the notion of learning a language that only bolsters my sort of faculties with the language I already speak was perfect for me, because there's no way that I'm going to, like, jump into another language,
yeah,
and, like,
dive head in.
Roll with it. You know, it's not for me. I'm too dumb for that, but I, yeah, I'd recommend Latin. Take Latin,
you're
kids.
Thinking about going to college. I always wondered about the difference between movie productions and, because we're used to going into a studio with, you know, four or five people in a band.
Yeah.
And then you may work with an engineer and a producer, and then maybe someone else may mix it. Someone else might master it, but that's kind of like the extent of the collaboration that goes into it. And I looked at a movie one, and there's so much more to it.
Oh, it's so wild. So I made a movie in 2009, and it was just like a kind of dick joke comedy. It's called Buzzard Country. It's about two burnouts that accidentally, like, stagger into a bunch of money and unwittingly get drawn into, like, the dumbest criminal underworld in a small town. It's pretty funny, but...
I remember this because this is what you... When we first met, you were working on.
Yeah, and, like, you know, for a second, like, I was, like, taking meetings with, like, TriStar and, like, Fox Searchlight and all this stuff, and I was like, I'm about to be, like, an auteur. Never mind that it's the dumbest fucking movie. I mean, like, every scene, there's, like, a joke about a penis. You know, like, it's not the kind of thing you really, like, make a career on, but for a second, I thought that things were going places, but it didn't. It kind of, like, languished on the vine. But the point I'm getting to is that, like, I wrote that and edited it and directed it, and I was in it along with my partner Nick, who I do The Wandering Birds with. He helped me every step of the way. And it's fascinating how much more, like, recording music in a studio versus, like, making a movie. It's like, there's like a, recording music is like the 2D version. There's like this whole other, like, because there's that component of making a movie.
Yeah.
Right? Like, totally. The audio, like, studio recording aspect of it is there, but then there's all this other shit, and that's the only stuff that anyone pays attention to.
Yeah.
Like, you know how, like, you go into the studio and you write a song and you, like, slave over some guitar part, or, like, you watch Eric slave over getting this, like, bass line exactly right?
Yeah.
And then at the end, the only thing anybody notices is the chorus.
Yeah.
Vocal.
Or the weird vocal thing that you added there that isn't even a line. You know,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
Some kind of...
And like, and it's like that with movies. Like, you do all this stuff and, like, you only notice anything in a movie if it sucks, you know, otherwise
it's true.
You're absorbed into it. Right. So it's like the entire process is based around being invisible, but it's, and there's not the same, it's very, very collaborative in the way that, like, everybody's there to play their position.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, like, I'll say to Neil, like, oh man, what about if we did this? What if we changed the mood like this? In movies, everybody's so specialized. It's like the gaffer's not going to go up to the DP and be like, what about this notion?
Yeah, totally.
You know, because it's just like they work in completely different disciplines. I mean, I actually used the worst possible example because those two crew members work in tandem quite a bit.
Yeah.
But you get the idea. Like, so you're really much more like sink or swim based on your own, like, siloed role in the thing. But
yeah. Seems like it'd be also the inverse maybe of that, like, if you wanted to have micromanage the movie, like, if you had this kind of creative notion or direction that you wanted to go in, you might not be able to do that because of how specialized the other roles are, like, and the people kind of just in their own world, and they kind of would be able to dictate what you can and can't do.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, like, listen, I'm no fancy Hollywood movie man, but like, I think that's why something like the Wes Anderson catalog is so noteworthy, because it's like he clearly is a micromanager of, like, every detail, right?
Yeah.
And it's like that's how that ends up looking. You know, I mean, I don't know. Maybe Michael Bay is the same way, and
maybe.
It's just like he, you know, he wants to make everything. So this is really interesting. When I was in film school, we had to watch a lot of Michael Bay movies.
Which at the time were still, like, what I'm thinking. There's, like, Transformers and kind of, like, the big exploding movies.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And shit.
Same shit. But, like, this professor I had, was like, look, you need to watch Michael Bay because he is the best. And do you know why he's the best? Because he started out making commercials. So he had 30 seconds to convey an emotion. And you watch a Michael Bay movie and you might not give a shit about it. It might be the dumbest movie you've ever seen. The characters might be wooden, but it will almost make you cry. And sure as shit, he's absolutely right. It's like the dude's just such a master of knowing like how to manipulate that medium. You know, it's like,
yeah,
it's like these emotions get, I'm drawing these emotions out of you by using this technique, this technique, this technique. They're proven, they work, boom. And that's why, like, you watch Armageddon and you're like, this is the dumbest fucking movie I've ever seen. Why am I like on the verge of tears and why can't I stop thinking about it?
That's awesome. I'm gonna take that into consideration. I'm gonna watch a Michael Bay movie and the next airplane I'm on. So that works. You know, he had a quote that I read. I might not say it exactly, but he said somebody was giving him shit in an interview for making, you know, lowbrow action movies or whatever. And he stopped and he was like, "So I make action movies for teenage boys. Is that so bad? Like, is there something so wrong with that?" And I was like, "Well, I guess not. No, you're kind of making, you're filling that role of cool exploding shit."
Yeah, you know, like the, I'm sure you deal with this all the time. I mean, more than me, more people care about what you do than what I do. But like the no, like now, I mean, there's so many things that this like sort of social media culture has like propagated. But one thing that I find endlessly fascinating is the notion that suddenly all art has to be about something. And like, you know, it's like the think piece about like, actually, Punky Brewster was a super woke feminist parable.
Oh, yeah.
Or like the problematic aspects of Family Matters. And it's like, dude, these, no, that is not, everything doesn't have to be a thing.
No.
Like, my buddy Eric, he like went to CU for fine art, and he's great. He was a photographer and a visual artist and stuff. And I was at his house. First of all, when they had the exhibit, which was like they put it up in the Denver Art Museum, and for the graduating class. And at the end of the night, everything was normal except for his section. There was like crumpled beer cans and a passed out dude. And I was like, oh, that's art. That is, yeah, cool. Like that's art. Right. But, he was telling me this story and I was looking at some of his pieces that had just been displayed, and he had this photograph and it had like a big 2-inch thick frame. And, he had hammered these like 4-inch nails through every single space in the frame. So it was like very, it didn't look punk, but like that's the best, like,
yeah, it was like industrial
antecedent, like, I could give you. Is like it looked like a like super studded like crusty jacket, but like with like long 4-inch nails, right? And I was like, "What's the significance of the nails?" And he's like, "They look cool." And I was like, "Oh right, that's what a picture's job is.
Totally,
is to look cool. Anything else is just like gravy. A song is supposed to sound cool. A movie is supposed to be watchable. To give it a job beyond that as an artist is suicide, and as a viewer is unbelievably presumptuous."
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I totally agree with that. It's so, I think that maybe it's a reaction to the fact that we're surrounded by so many lies in the face of art, like so many advertisements and so many things that are vying for our attention or trying to get us to feel certain ways we spend money on something, that people are grasping for authenticity. And I think that that's like giving people the benefit of the doubt who write those things. Really, I think they're just, I don't know.
Well, I mean, like intentionality is one thing, and like authenticity, you say authenticity and bring up advertising. I would argue that advertising is maybe the most authentic art form that there is, because,
I mean, straightforward.
Because it's end game is on the table.
Yeah.
Right? It's like the, I don't have any feelings either way about the Strokes. I picked them randomly. But it's like, they're also advertising. They're selling a product, which is like their lifestyle, them, these songs, this music, this merchandise, you know? And their advertising is the songs, right?
Yeah, you can make, yeah, I think
and,
you can
and,
say
but,
that.
But it's like couching, and again, I don't mean the Strokes specifically. I was just picking them,
sure,
as a random,
yeah,
band. And there's all this like sort of like argument that, like, oh, you know, I just don't care. It's just about the songs. And it's like, well, if it was really just about the songs, like, you wouldn't have, like, a management team and, like, be forced to go on tour and, like, all this kind of shit. Like,
yeah.
I mean, there's, like, a lifestyle that goes along with it. And you're selling yourself as somebody that's worthy of living that life.
Yeah.
Right?
You're the first person who brought this up to me years ago about the kind of what you're doing essentially in a band. And not to, like, to do such a distillation of what you said, you know, unjustly, but you were like, yeah, you're going and playing show music in front of people. They sing along, and then you ask them to buy a T-shirt. Like, what do you... What more do you think you're doing, or what less do you think you're doing that? Is there some kind of great virtuosity to it? Like, no.
Right. Yeah, no. It's like there's no, like, fucking higher calling when it comes to playing music. It's really, really fun.
Yeah.
And it's nice. But at the end of the day, you're, like, entertaining people who have had a shitty week.
Yeah.
You're the best time of their week. And then you're like, hey, listen, pay me a little bit of money and then wear my advertisement around.
Yeah. Use it to identify yourself.
So, I mean, like, listen, it is the greatest, and I'm, like, so grateful that I've been able to do it, and, like, I've been able to meet people like you, and, I mean, it's, like, the lifestyle is awesome, and it's wonderful, but it ain't fucking important at all, you know? Like, and, I mean, music is very important.
For
and
sure.
Music, from a consumption perspective, can be, like, the difference in somebody's fucking entire... worldview and their own attitude towards themselves or whatever. Like,
for sure.
It's very healing and stuff like that. But when you start taking credit for that as a producer of music, but that's when you end up being completely full of shit.
Yeah. Which maybe it's full of shit. Yeah. I mean, the whole thing itself just circles back to that. And it's just, yeah. Hard not to take yourself too seriously. Especially, I always find that it manifests mostly when you're getting your picture taken. Like, if they're like, yeah, we're going to do press photo shoots. It's like, okay, well, what emotion am I gonna, you know, how do I relate this back
yeah.
to?
Yeah, it's so.
You also taught us another really important lesson when it comes to that, and that's they're always gonna use the picture where you're holding the fucking rubber chicken. Like, if you're doing a photo shoot and there's any type of, like, novelty or anything involved, they're gonna pick that one.
Yeah, right. Whenever they're like, just do this, we won't use it, just, like, let's just see how it turns out. It's like, that's the one they're absolutely 100% using.
Yeah, for sure. The one where you have, like, a bag on your head.
But we did the Plea for Peace tour, the third one, I guess, Thursday was on it with us, and they were doing their, like, cover shoot for, like, Kerrang or Revolver or NME, like, one of those big, like, British glossies, and we were at the Electric Factory in Philly, and they were out back, and they were all just, like, you know, like, hands, like, locked in front of them, like, looking down, being very serious. And I went up behind the photographer and I just, like, pulled my balls out over my belt. And they all just started cracking up. And I was like, this is the picture you guys should use. Yeah. You know? But, I mean...
of course.
But, well...
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, nobody's that cool in those pictures. They're all just kind of, like, putting a shield up, I think. You know, it's like the... I mean, some people, maybe they got, like, one out of every 100 is, like, that cool, you know?
Seeing Clash a looked cool, that cool band promo photo is so rare. And when you see it, when I see one that's actually cool, I'm like, I will listen to this band.
Yeah.
Because it is so unbelievably rare to do it well. You know, it's kind of the same thing with band names. I mean, you know, like, you've done a million interviews, right? And people are like... Where'd your band name come from? Yeah. And it's like, okay, I can answer this question for every single fucking band that you ever interview for the rest of your life. We were all sitting around throwing out a bunch of stupid names, and somebody said something, and everyone's like, I don't hate that.
Yeah.
And there you go. Like, there you go.
Exactly.
That's like...
Yeah. 100% the total process to get that, for sure.
Yes.
There you go.
My
No sweat. We're just making... we're doing this inside the G-Man in Chicago next to Metro. My favorite bar in the world. Besides Dirty Frank's in Philadelphia, it's my first favorite bar, and then this bar.
Dirty Frank's? I don't think I've ever been to Dirty Frank's.
Nobody ever has. Nobody, you know, it's, like, I mean, it's right in the neighborhood. It's awesome.
That's what makes a great bar.
Yeah, totally. It's awesome. It's not like a hidden thing that, you know, nobody knows about, but it's like... But they had the Poet Laureate of Philadelphia was, like, the bouncer for, you know, it's like that kind of place.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's really awesome. You just run into really cool people there.
Yeah.
Oh, I was thinking about you recently while I was in Philly. You know Bam Margera's house you can rent on Airbnb?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I spent the night there once.
Yeah, I was with you.
That's right.
That night that we stayed at Bam Margera's house.
Good heavens. Yeah, that's right. Sorry. Yeah, that was... Yeah. You might have to forgive me for only remembering Novak spray painting his dick silver and running around in that Visigoth helmet and insisting that I sleep in the yard with him.
Yep. That's I was driving.
Yes, you were driving, and then we were with Ben and... Well, it doesn't matter who we were with. Yeah. None of that's important. But
we slept in the turret, the giant tower.
Yes.
That's what I always get to say. Yeah, that big spire. There's a hole, like a latch in the floor that was wooden with a key ring on it that you pulled up and climbed up the... that's where
I
slept.
Do you think that there's still... I slept in one of those hotel rooms. You know how there's that motel inside?
Oh, yeah.
I slept in the motel room, but... Yeah, wild. Do you think he still has all those big, gigantic murals of Osama bin Laden all over the place now that he's renting it on Airbnb?
I forgot about that. There was that in there. I don't know. I mean, no, not if it's not that he's renting it on Airbnb.
You got to figure that's bad luck.
Get a code over that. The weird thing was his cousin that looked and dressed just like him, that was his driver.
Weird
cult of personality thing. But the kicker for me was when we were leaving that morning and that guy with the spray painted his dick.
Novak,
We were leaving. We had to go out of the complex and there was a giant gate to get out. And we opened the gate and we were driving. And that guy was just passed out in the field across the street, a quarter mile away from the house with like a sleeping bag and a football helmet on.
He's like, you and me are sleeping in the yard. I'm like, you and me are not sleeping in the yard, actually. You couldn't be more wrong about that.
Yeah. And they were fucking with that guy because he was going to jail for the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
He was on like the weekend jail thing because he crashed the one dude's car or something like that.
Holy shit. That was... So, I don't mean to drive your podcast here, but back in the day... Back long, long ago when I was undeservedly more famous than Tom, he drove me on this weekend tour that I did. It was the guy from Blink-182 and me playing acoustic. And
I was doing merch for the guy from Blink-182.
Yeah, and Tom, I was able to, one of his side hustles before the big time, he drove me around and did some merch. And it was a disastrously awesome weekend. I mean, it was so fun, but I mean, like, I'm dying a full 10 years earlier than I was going to because of that weekend.
Yeah, it was hard to drive, and I can't say a lot of what it did because of the fact that I was driving. I mean, I could totally say it, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, that was, for sure. That was, like, the right at the cusp of before my body would not allow me to do those things anymore.
Oh, totally.
It's like, right, I think I was, there's 27 or something.
There's no living like that now, but it was fun times.
Yeah, it was wild.
That was the that first night was my most disastrous show. And
at the Mercury Lounge in Manhattan.
Well, I've had three extremely disastrous shows, and that is one of them. And that one I didn't actually get through one single song.
Nope. But people loved it. I mean, you were extremely captivating.
That's the thing, is that these three terrible shows I played, it was one with the Falcon in Chicago. One, that's the one where I fell into the drums. You can still see that clip on YouTube.
Oh, of course.
To my great, great pleasure. and then in LA when somebody, that was the day I decided that I would never do shots again because somebody slipped something in my drink and like I went face down on stage like 3 minutes into the show and then I came to afterwards and Neil was yelling at me and I was like, whoa, 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 whoa. What?
Yeah, what happened?
And because
of that story, I still am wary to like take shots of the fans of our band who are like, hey, can I buy you a drink?
I was like, sure.
But one time, my own friend.
Like, you know, Mike won't, Fat Mike of NoFX, famous for his punditry regarding mass shootings.
Punditry.
Fat Mike is a very sweet, smart, good man with a good soul. That's all I'll say about that. But he will not accept a drink from somebody unless he sees the bartender port and hand it to him.
That's a good idea, especially with a lot of their fans, I would imagine.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I've learned a lot from him just from that stuff because, you know, But after that show in LA, where I was, you know, drugged, I called Matt Skiba, and he is, you know, one of my very close friends, and I was just like, dude, I just humiliated myself in front of, it was the first time we'd ever sold out to Troubadour, you know, it was like a big deal.
And, big fucking deal.
And I totally boofed it, and he was like, and Matt was like, dude, listen to me. Everything you ever do in this business that you think is embarrassing and humiliating and you hate, that's what everyone will love the most. And everything that you put your heart and soul into and care about, no one will ever notice. And he was not wrong.
No, I don't think he was.
No. Damn. And it's just fucking, good grief. And it's just fucking, it's astounding. Like, you can't, I mean, the entire nature of this whole thing is like so unpredictable, and like what sticks and what doesn't is wild, right? I mean, like, I don't even understand. Like, we just finished a tour and we have more fans than we've ever had.
Yeah.
And how's that? I mean, I'm 41 years old. I'm not supposed to be like still climbing. You know what I mean? I'm supposed to be like coming back on a reunion tour to diminishing returns at this point, but. You know,
like the unpredictability of the entire thing, and that the fleeting and fickle nature of the what people like is something that, you know, both of us doing this for so long, I've seen bands come up and down and up and down. We've opened for bands and had seen the way that their relationships work and change. And anytime that we're sitting around now having a couple of drinks and people are talking about what people really want or the moving trends or what's going to be big and what's not, it's just fodder, man. To me, it's just kind of like, this is so wildly unpredictable. I'm not, if someone figured it out, they would have figured it out, you know, like
you couldn't have said it more succinctly. If there was a formula, we'd all be using it.
Exactly.
You know, and then it wouldn't be cool. I mean, like it becomes like a snake eating its own tail,
exactly,
right?
Because the then it would be like, would make it not
but I mean, it's like, that's what I've always liked about your band, is that like you guys just write good songs, and it's not like it's not inspired by the moving seas that are going on around you. And it's like, I mean, for, you know, to a lesser extent with my band, like we were so hated for so long. Like, I mean, when we first started, like, you know, I used to be in that ska band that was fairly popular. And so when we first started, everybody hated the Lawrence Arms because we weren't a ska band, right? And then, like, emo came around, and we were, like, touring with Thursday and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And everybody hated us. I mean, I've told this story so many times, but it is worth repeating. We played this festival in New Bedford, Massachusetts, called New Bedford Fest. And we come in, and we're just, like, long hair, just drinking 40s. Everyone else there is, like, pretty much straight edge, or at least humorless.
Yeah.
And, like, we have, like, big, like, baggy pants. It was the late 90s or early 2000s, and just like ripped up like flannel shirts and like long hair and like trucker hats with the brims flipped up, and we're drunk, and we go in, and everybody in there is just like bangs and sadness and black
and fear,
you know. And we start playing this song called A Toast, which is like one of our old songs. At the time, it was a new song. We opened with this song, and after the second chorus, Chris has a guitar solo, and when he got to the guitar solo, the audience erupted into laughter, like as though it were a comedy show, because like the idea of doing a guitar solo was so like gauche, you know, for the time. And then after that, it was pop punk, and we were on tour with like Yellow Card and The Starting Line. And if we didn't fit in with the Thursday fucking crowd, and listen, the fucking backflip and fiddle player set didn't take us either. I mean, like, we were old men then, and I was like 25, you know? And,
yeah.
And it's just like, so we were always like so hated, but just like, we're like, okay, these are the only, I was like, these are the only songs I know how to write. And Chris was like, these are the only songs I know how to write. So, and, you know, it's ended up giving us like a longevity. And
sure, you're like, saying now they have more fans than ever. That's because those songs, that they, you know, hold their own, and they hold it for people.
Yes, and that's what I like about your band, is the same thing. It's like, just like a, it's like a dedication to the wellspring of where your ideas come from and the purity of that, as opposed to trying to manipulate that into whatever, anything else that's going on.
Hell yeah. We, when we are doing support tours with like opening up for bigger bands, we always use the metric of how many of our fans there are, judging by how many Lawrence Arms t-shirts you can see per person in the crowd. So we owe you that. Thank you very much.
Hey, you know, we do try to mark our territory.
Hell yeah. But yeah, man, what have you got coming up?
What are you working on?
I'm
doing this Wandering Birds record. I'm trying to get it done by Fest, like, so it's out by Fest.
Nice.
It is, I've partnered again with Nick, who's like my oldest friend. We've been making music together since we were 12. And when we were kids, he had a four-track. I mean, he's a genius virtuoso. He plays like every instrument.
Awesome.
And he's been like engineering and recording since he was a little kid. And we used to always make just these very bizarre, like sort of like left of center pop rock kind of weird songs that were just like sort of kind of funny, kind of absurdist or whatever. And we kind of hinted at that a little on the first Wandering Birds record, but this is like all in. It's a very, I'm really, really excited about it. I think, like, if it, let's say it comes out in October, 5 years from October, people will be like, wow, that record's really good.
Oh, yeah. What you played for me before sounded great. I'm really excited to hear it. I'm fucking stoked, man.
Yeah, it's cool. It's like, it's not a rock record at all. But it's very much like, this is the record I've been like training to write with Nick since I was 12, you know, and it's really exciting to see it come together and be like, oh yeah, this music, like, we've been doing stuff like this for a very long time and we are adept at this, and it's really fun.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Fucking hell yeah. It's awesome. Well, I thank you so much for doing with this me.
Oh, dude, it's a pleasure.
Yeah, fuck yeah, man.
Anything.
Much appreciated. Thank you so much.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Of course, buddy.
Cheers, brother.
Yeah.
Thank you, thank you, thank you so much for listening, and a huge thanks to Brendan Kelly, whom I'm hoping to have back so soon. We're currently out on the road. If you think you know somebody that would make for an interesting conversation while I'm out here, email me at tom@futurefriday.net, and I'll see if I can make it happen while we're out on this the U.S. tour for Hello Exile. And thanks again to Sean and everybody over at Ridge.com for the awesome wallets and bags and shit. We will see you soon.
Hey, what's up? My name's Lurk, and I'm the host of Lamb Goat's Van Flip Podcast. Every week, I have in-depth conversations with bands from all over the scene, big and small. We also like to keep our finger on the pulse and showcase up-and-coming bands on the show as well. So come check out Lamb Goat's Van Flip Podcast.
Hey, you. Do you have any plans this year? Ha! How's that going? Did you get 2020? Well, welcome to a brand new podcast called 2020, where myself, Benny Goodman, and my good friends Corey Pazin and Siobhan Cronin from the band Lost Symphony also got 2020.
And since the world ended this year, we decided why not just check in with some of our friends in the music industry and see how everyone's doing.
We're going to get a candid look at life on and off the stage, as well as the mindset of some of the most successful people in the entertainment industry.
New episodes drop every Sunday and Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern.
And you can listen at 2020-D.com, SoundTalentMedia.com, or on your favorite podcast app.